Good morning, Paradox class. Today is 7/17/22 for Paradox class, and we have a special guest speaker today, which we're really looking forward to. It's Ken Samples, and he's a philosopher and theologian and is a senior research scholar for Reasons to Believe. And prior to joining RTB, Reasons to Believe, in 1997, Ken worked 7 years for a research consultant and a correspondence editor for Christian Research Institute, which he co-hosted the Bible Answer Man show with Walter Martin. And he's been in a lot of magazines, Christianity Today, Christian Research Journal, Facts of Faith. And he also has written a lot of really good books. And I have some here. We have World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth, Claims to the Worldview Test. And we have God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader. And then I believe his latest book is Christianity Cross-Examined. It is a rational, relevant, and good. And so I'm glad to invite Ken up here and... looking forward to the class today, and he'll be speaking on Not All Dead Men Stay Dead.
Thank you very much. Okay, this is kind of part two to a topic I addressed a couple weeks ago by the same title, Not All Dead Men Stay Dead. And in that lecture, I talked about the worldview of naturalism. That's the secular atheistic worldview, if you will. The universe is all there is. There's no God. There's no soul. There's no life after death. And we talked a little bit about how naturalism views death. And they view it as the end. There's nothing more to death. Death ends all. Well, today I want to talk with you about... more about the resurrection. Last time we talked a bit about the conversion of the apostles James and Thomas and Paul, but today I'm going to give you an expanded edition. So I want to discuss what I call in my book, Christianity Cross-Examined, 20 Evidences for the Resurrection of Jesus. And I'd like to underscore by just saying this, that if Jesus is risen from the dead, then there isn't anything more important for people to hear than that message. Because we all know when we reflect that we're going to die. And if death is the end, then that is very different than the message that we hear in Christianity, which is that death is not the end. So let's talk about the evidences for the resurrection. And of course, the place we begin with the resurrection is the empty tomb of Jesus. There's a lot we know about the tomb. The story of the empty tomb is very early in the resurrection message. We know whose tomb that Jesus was buried in. He was taken down off of the cross, suffering death by crucifixion by the Romans. He was prepared for burial, and his close associates placed him in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. Well, on Sunday morning, the women went to the tomb. Jesus had women followers, which was really quite extraordinary for the time. Typically, rabbis did not have women followers. But Jesus, of course, treats women very differently than the Greeks and the Romans. And even Jews, he treats them with dignity and respect. And I think both women and men found in Jesus a voice and a source of truth and love that captivated them. So the women go to the tomb, and they find the tomb open, and they find it vacant. It's empty. The body is gone. The story of the empty tomb is a critical one, because if Jesus' body had been discovered, then Christianity is dead in the water. It would have stopped before it really ever got going, because a body that is found in the tomb would not be resurrected. Now, of course, what's interesting is, and we'll make this number two, our second evidence for the resurrection, Jesus makes enemies. He is motivated, in my mind, by two things always, truth and love. But he comes to those who affirm his faith, that is the Hebrew religion, what we call today Judaism. But there are leaders within the Hebrew faith that reject him as the Messiah. And so he is seen as someone who is an enemy of Judaism, and even the Romans see him as a potential challenge to Caesar. So those in charge, they concede that the tomb was empty because they say, let's tell everybody, they say, look, that person Jesus claimed that he was going to be raised from the dead. So let's tell everybody that the disciples came in the middle of the night and stole the body. So that's the first alternative theory to try to explain the resurrection. But of course, there are problems with that. If the disciples came in the middle of the night, or if people claimed, for example, later that they went to the wrong tomb, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. They knew what tomb it was. It belonged to Joseph of Arimathea, and the chief priests, they made sure that the tomb was guarded. So a concession on the part of people who objected to Jesus' ministry is a very powerful concession. It's not just the women and later the apostles that found the tomb open and vacant. The religious leaders and the Romans admitted, yeah, the tomb was indeed empty. This has led scholars to say that one of the most foundational truths about the resurrection is that Jesus' tomb was indeed empty. All right, let's go to number three. People who are celebrities, people who are very well known, when they're buried, usually they have a certain amount of veneration that goes on to them. I have visited the burial site of C.S. Lewis, there right outside of Oxford in the churchyard of Trinity Anglican Church. And I've read his name there on the tomb that he has, or on the headstone, I should say, rather. I've also visited the burial place of President John F. Kennedy in Virginia at Arlington Cemetery, and he's buried here, and then his wife is buried next to them, and they have one of their children that died very early buried next to them. So millions of people have come to JFK's burial site, and I would say probably maybe a million people have visited C.S. Lewis's site. He's extraordinarily popular. Well, when somebody is well known and they're buried, there is a tomb, and people venerate the tomb. It happens in other religions as well, Confucianism, for example. But historically, there has never been a tomb that was venerated as belonging to Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have ideas about where the tomb that Jesus was laid in, but nobody has a tomb where they are committed to the idea that he is dead and buried there. So no veneration belonging to Jesus would be my third argument for the resurrection. Number four, Jesus appeared alive to many eyewitnesses following his death. Now, if you're going to explain the resurrection in a purely naturalistic way, let's assume nothing happens supernatural. If you're going to explain what happened to Jesus purely in naturalistic terms, then your explanatory model is going to get a bit more complicated here with number four. Because first you'd have to explain, well, why is the tomb empty? What happened there? What happened to Jesus' body? Because if you could reproduce it, then Christianity is falsified. But now that people were having experiences, that is, they were seeing Jesus, they were encountering Jesus, now you're going to have to explain that. That's a second part of the resurrection explanation that you're going to have to provide inferences for. Now, when we think about this, Jesus appeared to many eyewitnesses following his death. This is really a rather extraordinary thing. I mean, it's hard to explain these encounters. Why? Because they're very diverse. Jesus appears sometimes outside, other times in buildings. He appears during the night. He appears during the day. He appears to single individuals. He appears to multiple individuals. At least on one occasion, he may have appeared to a multitude of people. And there are experiences where he shows himself, where people can see the wounds that are in his hands or his wrist, the wound in the side. So this is a very dynamic experience of Jesus appearing to various people over a period of time. It didn't just happen one day. It happened over a 40-day period. And some people saw Jesus multiple times. Some saw him only single times. He appeared to friends, appears to enemies, appeared to his own brother, James, who I think you could make a case. James likely thought his brother Jesus was mentally ill. James is converted by it. Of course, he appears to Thomas. He appears to the enemy, Saul, who becomes the Apostle Paul. Well, this is really an interesting and powerful evidence. Somebody like Gary Habermas, who may be one of the world's specialists on the resurrection, Gary Habermas argues that when people have hallucinations, and people do have hallucinations, but typically when they have hallucinations, it doesn't do anything to transform their moral lives. Usually what happens when they have an hallucination, over a period of time, they recognize that it's false, and then they move away from it. It doesn't have any enduring influence, particularly in terms of transformation. So you've got the empty tomb. Now you've got these appearances of Jesus. And by the way, even critical scholars, that is liberal scholars, skeptical scholars, atheistic scholars, lots of people are interested in the New Testament besides Christians. Some are interested just professionally. Others are interested maybe even trying to disprove it. Maybe others are even saying, well, I don't believe the actual story, but maybe there's some truth here that I can discover. But even critical scholars accept the idea that the followers of Jesus had some kind of real, genuine, authentic experience. They were seeing something. Now, the critical scholars don't think they were seeing what the New Testament says they were seeing, but they admit that they were having some kind of religious experience. Now, when your critics begin conceding points like that, then the evidence begins increasing. It's not just the apostles who claimed the tomb was empty, but it is the enemies of Jesus, those who saw Jesus as a threat to Judaism, they admit the tomb is empty. When we see the experiences, people usually don't come away thinking the apostles were lying about these experiences. And we also know that these experiences had enduring influence. Now, there is a dispute about how many Christians were persecuted and became martyrs in the early church, but it's quite clear that a number of key biblical figures went on to be martyred. It's certainly the case for James, the brother of Jesus. It's true of Peter and Paul, who were executed in the Neronian persecution. So all three of those had experiences of the Lord, and it changed their life dramatically. So our fourth evidence is the appearances of Jesus to various eyewitnesses following his death. Number five, the documentary sources of the resurrection story are considered reliable. That is, the Gospels are largely considered, almost exclusively considered, to be something like ancient biographies. And these testify to the life of Jesus. All four of the Gospels talk about his death. They talk about the resurrection to some degree, some more detail than others. But we know where these sources came from. If we think about the four Gospels, let's look at the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. These are called synoptic Gospels because they have a similar synopsis. They have a similar perspective. They contain some of the very same details, sometimes in very same, if not exactly the same language. And then you have a fourth Gospel, John, that is different, that talks about theological issues in some ways of a different way. But if we look at the four Gospels, and of course, it is true that the Gospels don't come with particular authors' names attached. When we read Paul's writings, I, Paul, wrote this letter, right? The Gospels come anonymous to us. But that doesn't mean that we don't know who wrote the Gospels. The early church tradition, people like Irenaeus, Papias, others talk about a tradition that identified the authors as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, what's interesting even there is if I were going to make up this story, first, I don't know why I would do it. I don't know why in the world I would make up a legend about Jesus, but let's say maybe people had a reason to do that. I doubt that they would have picked the authors to write the Gospels that the church said wrote them. It's kind of an odd collection. For example, let's begin with Mark. Mark's not one of the original 12. We don't have a lot of information about Mark. He's described in the book of Acts as having some association with Paul and Barnabas, but he's not one of the original 12. Why in the world would there be a biography of Jesus attributed to Mark? Well, the early church said that Mark was the Emmanuelus to Peter, and that Peter had his talking points. Remember, early part of Acts, Peter is the chief preacher of the early Christian movement. Well, if Mark is his Emmaus, if he's the one that writes things for him, then it would make a lot of sense. And if you look at the manuscripts, there are times where you can see kind of another testimony coming forward. So if Mark is the presenter of Peter, that makes perfect sense. Peter is one of the original 12. Peter is one of the inner circle. Roman Catholics even believe that Peter became the first pope. So Mark would associate in apostolic authority with Peter. Now Matthew, of course, is one of the original apostles. Luke, another odd choice. Who's Luke? He's not even a Jew. He's a doctor. He doesn't appear until we hear him writing about his venture in Luke and Acts to try to figure out what was going on. But of course, here is another explanation for the choice of Luke. Luke has a close association with Paul. Paul has a deep association with Christianity. So Luke would make sense if his connection comes through Paul. So we've got the testimony of Matthew. We've got the testimony secondhand from Peter through Mark. We've got the testimony of Paul through Luke. And then we have John. And the traditional interpretation is that this is the Apostle John, who would have been part of the inner circle. So if you look at those Gospels, you have Peter, Paul, and John coming, and then you have Matthew. Now, how soon did these Gospels appear? Well, let's let's say that scholars think that Jesus was probably born somewhere between 6 and 4 BC. He wasn't born in the year 1 AD. Most scholars think that he's born around 6 to 4 BC, maybe closer to 4 BC. Scholars debate his death. The two dates, the 2 year dates that are debated are 30 and 33 AD. But if he's born about 4 BC and he dies 30 AD, then we have roughly something close to the 33-year ministry. Well, that might surprise you. I mean, we don't know exactly what year Jesus was born. Well, let me give you a little perspective. Let's think about Siddhartha Gautama, who becomes the Buddha, right? Buddha scholars don't know what century Buddha was born in. They don't know if he was born as early as the 6th century, as early as the 4th century, or sometimes during the 5th century. With regard to knowledge about the Buddha, some would suggest that the first evidence we have about his teaching comes 600 years after his death. Well, let's look at Jesus. Let's suppose, and we'll take conservative dates and liberal dates, let's suppose that the Gospels are all in existence, maybe in the late 50s, maybe in the early 60s, maybe John a little bit later in 70. Those are conservative dates. Well, if Jesus dies in 30 AD, the Gospels appear in the late 50s, then we're looking at, what, 25 years? Earlier into the 60s, then maybe 30 or 35 years. Maybe for John, 40 years, as compared to what, 600 years? Liberal dates, maybe the Gospels all appear, the Synoptic Gospels appear in the 70s, maybe John's Gospel appears in 90, or maybe in the early part of the second century. That's not a lot of time. I was raised in a Roman Catholic family. My parents were evangelicals from the great state of West Virginia. My dad was a coal miner, so you might say I'm a coal miner son. Have you ever heard a song? Well, it's daughter instead of son, but I'm a coal miner son. Well, my dad was drafted into World War II, fought against the Germans in the European theater of war. And when he was in Rome in 1944, when Rome was liberated, he saw the Vatican. And I think that had a big impact on my dad. Now, think about it. My dad probably never went to a church as large as 100 members, probably never in that large a church. He walks into St. Peter's, and it can seat 65,000 people. He even saw a group of people dialoguing with the Pope. I think that had an influence on my dad. And so in the early 60s, my parents converted along with me to Catholicism. I was baptized at St. Athanasius Parish in Long Beach. Athanasius, I didn't know it at the time, one of the great defenders of the deity of Christ and of the Trinity. On the front door of the church, it says Athanasius Contra Mundum. There was a time in which Christianity was deeply influenced by Arianism. And if you don't know what Arianism is, just talk with your local Jehovah's Witness. They believe virtually the same thing. They deny the Trinity, the Incarnation, the deity of the Son and the Spirit. And at one point, when the church looked like it was being pushed in that direction, Athanasius said boldly, "Is the whole world against Athanasius? Then it's Athanasius against the world." Now, I feel my ministry has largely been in the spirit of St. Athanasius. But going back to that period of time, I remember the day President Kennedy was shot. And I remember it because I saw a couple things I'd never seen before. I never saw my dad ever come home from work early. And I don't remember seeing my mother cry. And my mom cried. And then the next Sunday, he's killed on a Friday morning in Dallas. Sunday morning, We're getting ready for Mass. My dad and I are watching this little black and white TV. It had rabbit ears. If you don't know what that is, talk to some of the older folks. They'll tell you a little bit about that. But they showed a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald, and then all of a sudden a dark figure reaches out and shoots Oswald in the abdomen, Jack Ruby. Well, that's now, next year, it'll be 60 years. I can remember it pretty clearly, even as a five-year-old boy. I can remember the casket being led down the streets of Washington with the flag, and I remember Jacqueline Kennedy wearing all black and all the figures of the funeral. I say all of that to indicate that there are experiences that stay in your mind that you don't forget. If you talk to my dad, he'll tell you about Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic from Paris, from New York to Paris. Talk to my mother, she'll tell you where she was when Pearl Harbor was bombed. There are things that are, the impact of them stay with you. The documentary sources are early. The documentary sources are strong. We know as much about the resurrection of Jesus as we do, for example, that Jerusalem was sacked by the Romans in 70 AD, or that Caesar was killed. So we have lots of solid historical evidence. And these documents, even though we're not quite sure what year Jesus is born or exactly what year he died, we know a whole lot more than what the Buddha scholars know about Buddha, what the Islamic scholars know about Muhammad, what the Confucian scholars know about Confucius. So that's our fifth argument for the resurrection. Number six, testimonies come from direct eyewitnesses or those close to eyewitnesses. Well, again, we just review that material. Matthew is an eyewitness. Mark is not a direct eyewitness, but if he's writing for Peter, Peter's an eyewitness. Luke is not a direct eyewitness, but his association with Paul is an eyewitness. If John, the apostle, wrote John, then John is an eyewitness. And so we have either eyewitness testimony or people who have close association with people who were eyewitnesses. That's pretty strong. It's not perfect. Eyewitness testimony is never perfect. People see things. I have friends who have spent their life in law enforcement. They will tell you, talk to detectives, talk to people who've investigated crimes. Eyewitness testimony is not perfect, but it's pretty solid. So the documents are early and they're reliable in terms of testimony. Number six. Number seven, very little time passed between the actual events and the early records. Well, we've touched upon that. If Jesus dies in 30, if the Gospels appear in the late 50s or in the early 60s, then we're dealing with somewhere between 25 to 35 years. Even if we stretch it out further, it's 40 or 50 years. I can remember JFK being killed, and that's been almost 60 years ago. So little time, again, compared with other claims that are made. Number eight, the canonical Gospels bear no resemblance to later apocryphal stories. Now, this is a pretty important point because some people who would like to dismiss Christianity say that maybe it's mythical, maybe it's legendary, maybe Christianity kind of reached out and copied some of the apocryphal stories about gods that were in the time-space world by the Greeks and Romans, and they had life and then death and then resurrection. And so some people would like to say Christianity is just one more of those myths. You have Mithra, you have various other so-called deities, and so Christianity is just a copycat. Well, the problem is that the canonical Gospels and the way Christianity is described, they don't comport with those mythical legends. And many of them are very inexact, very late. the Christian Gospels don't fit well with that, and even critical scholars accept the idea that the Gospels are different. Let me quote one of the experts about myth and legend, a man named C.S. Lewis. Lewis said, I know all about myth. I know all about legend. And he did. I can give you evidence that not only did C.S. Lewis claim to have read voluminously, but there's good evidence for Lewis's claim that he could remember everything he read. Now, think about that. Think about that for a moment. I have 5,000 books in my own personal library. I've read all of them, or if not from page one to the end, I've read from all of them, but I don't remember every detail. Lewis used to play kind of games with his students. He'd allow them to pick a book out of his library. He wouldn't see it. They would read a statement. Lewis would tell them what book it's from, would give them the context, and then would read a couple paragraphs of what follows. C.S. Lewis, I think, was not only a genius, he may have been one of the most educated people of the 20th century, if not of Western civilization. Maybe his competition would be Mortar Jerome Adler, who's the editor of the great books of the Western world for the Encyclopedia Britannica. But all of that, they're my two of my intellectual heroes. All of that simply to say, Lewis said, look, I know myth, and the Gospels are not myth. They're not myth, meaning that they're like these apocryphal myths. If they are myth, they're the true myth. They're a story about God coming into the world, dying and raising, that actually happened in history. And that was part of Tolkien and the other Inklings persuading Lewis to take Christianity seriously. So the Gospels don't bear resemblance to the apocryphal writings. Number nine, the Gospels meet the criterion of embarrassment. I think this is an interesting one. Let's again suppose that Ken decides he's going to make up the Gospel for some reason. Usually authors don't tell embarrassing things about themselves. Unless, I think probably only Christian authors ever describe themselves in terms that they're criticized. Usually authors want to make themselves look good, and if I'm trying to persuade you, I don't want to look bad, and I don't want to let my community look bad. But the truth of the matter is, if you read the Gospels and you read the book of Acts, the Christian community looks bad from time to time. Peter, who is one of the inner circle, he denies knowing Jesus three times. Imagine that. Imagine Peter's guilt later when he encounters again the resurrected Jesus. Whoa. Imagine Paul. What was that thorn in his side? Was that maybe an eye problem that he had? I can tell you, when you're a bookish person, having eye problems are real problems. But it might be a little bit of guilt. You know, maybe Saul was a jihadist. I mean, he came along the Christian community and said, this is a cult. They're perverting Judaism. Got to get rid of them. If that means imprisoning, so be it. If it means killing them, okay. Later, Paul realizes he captured and had the lambs of the Son put to death. Thomas denies Jesus. All of the apostles look cowardly. Embarrassment. Well, usually when things like that are included, people think, this actually happened. They're willing to kind of give you the straight scoop. I think that that's a very interesting argument for the resurrection, that it includes these embarrassing components. Number 10, the resurrection fulfills prophecies made by Jesus himself. Now, what if the resurrection just happened out of thin air? There was no anticipation of it. There was no prediction of it. I mean, can I tell you personally, when I first read the Gospels straight through, This was about 1978. I was a nominal Catholic. I never read the Gospels, never read any of the Old Testament. Though if you were in my neighborhood and you talked bad about Jesus and Mary and Joseph, I might punch you. But I didn't really follow the ethical teaching of Catholicism or of Christianity. But when I did begin to take the gospel seriously and I read them, I came to the conclusion that it's likely that Jesus really was the God-man. I mean, who could say on one hand, I am the way, the truth, and the life? Who could say things like, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest? Buddha never said that. Muhammad never said anything like that. Krishna never said anything like that. Moses never said anything exactly like that. Jesus seems to be the kind of person where he speaks to people who are hurting, people who've gone through difficulties in life, mental health challenges, financial challenges, family challenges. Jesus goes around talking to them and says, you know, the burden and the anxiety you have, if you come to me, I'll give you peace and rest. I went to see Mike, my friend down here who was at a hospital a number of years ago at St. Jude Hospital, and I walked into the lobby, and in large letters in the lobby is Matthew 28:19. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And I started to cry. I thought, he is the great physician. I read those Gospels, and I thought, man, who is this? What kind of man is this? Well, the resurrection doesn't poof out of thin air. Jesus talks about his soon coming resurrection. And when you look at his life of miracles, his life of teaching, you expect that something more has to happen. It can't end on the cross. And it doesn't end on the cross. The resurrection fulfills the testimony that Jesus gave on numerous occasions. Number 11, without the resurrection, Jesus would have been considered a false prophet. Now, there are theories. Judaism has had a number of theories about the way to explain Jesus. Early on, they called him a blasphemer. Some people at the time said maybe he's involved in evil spirits. Maybe that's why he can do the miraculous. Others have said maybe he's just a misunderstood person who thought the second coming would happen in the first century. It never did. But of course, if the apostles had not seen the resurrection, they would have reason to doubt Jesus because he had predicted it. So the prediction bears great power in that context. Number 12, the apostles were transformed from cowards to bold preachers of the resurrection. You know, as an adult, I've only been afraid a couple times, I think, honestly, where I was really afraid. One time, my wife and I were living in Anaheim, and my wife came home late from work, about 12 midnight, and I was waiting for her. She worked the night shift, and as I was waiting, I heard a scream coming from the parking lot. When I went out there, a man had confronted my wife. So I attacked him, and we're fighting in an alleyway in complete darkness in the middle of the night. And all I knew was, if it's between him and my wife, he's going down. But I was afraid. I was afraid for my wife. I was afraid for myself. Another time I've been afraid is when a doctor came to me when my daughter Jacqueline was in hospital, and he said, she's got the, now I got to get this right. Is it the H1N1 or is it N1H1? She had one of those early viruses. And the doctor said, I want you and your wife to go up and really be encouraging and supportive. He said, I had a young gal about your daughter's age, and she had the same thing and she passed away. So I was like, what do I do? There have been other times where my kids have been in difficult times and I was afraid. I was afraid. Well, the apostles were afraid. I remember my father telling me in World War II, I said, Dad, what do you do when you run out of ammo? He said, well, on a couple of occasions, we picked up our bayonet and we went at it. Now, how do you take that out of your mind? You know, there were things my relationship with my dad wasn't always the best, but I have a lot of compassion on my dad. My dad had great trauma. How do you deal with that? Well, the apostles were afraid. They were afraid they were going to be arrested. They were afraid they might be killed. And yet, when they saw Jesus, when they encountered him, it transformed their life. I mentioned before, Habermas says that typically hallucination doesn't transform the person morally. And they went from cowards to they're really to stand up for whatever it is. Well, if Jesus is risen from the dead, how bad can life be if Jesus is risen from the dead? He's conquered death. He's there. He was there for his apostles. He's there for us. That's the way I like to look at life. When life throws me difficult things. The other night I was feeling kind of anxious about, I was feeling rather insecure about a couple things that were happening in my life. And I said to myself, Ken, what if that's completely true? What if you are insecure? What if you do have all these problems? Does that mean God doesn't love you? Got financial problems? Maybe one of your children has drug problems? Last time I checked with Dave Rockstad and Hugh Ross, God created maybe multiple trillions of galaxies. If he can create those galaxies, can he work in your life and in my life? All of that to say, these are people who are committed to him. And out of those experiences, they're no longer cowards. Number 13, the day of worship, Sunday. Sunday has no biblical, no Hebraic meaning or importance whatsoever. The Sabbath is sundown Friday, sundown Saturday. Sunday it's a pagan day. By the way, they're all pagan days. By the way, they're all days created by God that some of the pagans name. But Sunday doesn't have any importance whatsoever except for this one little detail. That's the day Jesus rose from the dead. So it appears, even in the Gospels and in church history, that the disciples start meeting for worship on the first day of the week. Why? To celebrate the resurrection. Doesn't have any significance in a Hebrew-Jewish context. Now, of course, I like to say to my Seventh-day Adventist friends and my Sabbatarian Christian friends, if you want to worship on the Sabbath, God bless you. You can do that in good conscience if that you're feel led to that. I want to promote Christian unity. I simply want to make the point that Sunday has no meaning except for the resurrection. And by the way, the Christians said, it's the Lord's Day. So what are you supposed to do every single Lord's Day? Celebrate the resurrection. You could argue Sunday, every Sunday is Easter. Why Sunday? No biblical context. Oh, yeah. Jesus rose from the dead that day. Why does the church keep Sunday and attribute to the resurrection? I think that's an evidence for the resurrection. 14, Saul of Tarsus underwent a radical conversion from enemy of Christians to ardent apologist and missionaries. Remember my talk last time? I mentioned Thomas, James, and Paul. Thomas is very skeptical, even though his friends, his colleagues, his fellow apostles, they've seen the resurrection Jesus. He has not. Hey, let me be able to put my finger here in the wrist, my hand in the side. Give me some empirical data. James, I think, is the most interesting of all. James is the brother of Jesus. I always think, what did Mary say? James, couldn't you be more like Jesus? That's got to be a difficult road to hoe, right? Well, I think there's evidence that the family of Jesus at one point thought that maybe Jesus was mentally ill. It says that they went to take control over him. I mean, understandably, Mary's seen a lot of miracles. But remember what Jesus is doing. He's living in first century a Jewish monotheistic context, and he goes around saying things like, I and the Father, we are one. He reaches into the Old Testament and grabs the most sacred name of God, I am. Why wouldn't Jesus' family think, who's wrong, the Jewish community or our family member? Imagine how embarrassed James must have been. Ever been embarrassed by your family? Has your family ever been embarrassed by you? Imagine the embarrassment that James must have thought of his brother making these claims. And then you got Paul. Is he a Taliban? He's willing to kill people who he thinks are heretical. And then something happens. These very skeptical people, Thomas, James, and Saul, or Paul, they're very skeptical. And then their lives get turned upside down. And Paul goes from being the greatest enemy of Christendom to being the greatest missionary theologian of early Christianity. Something happened, and even the higher critical scholars admit it. Something happened to these people. Now, we're not sure that it's exactly what the New Testament says, but we admit it's hard to explain. Number 15, Paul's letters are replete with early references to the resurrection. Some people say, for example, well, you know, the Gospels don't talk all that much about the resurrection. Well, they talk quite a bit. Maybe Mark is left, particularly if you have an absence of the ending of Mark. But remember what fills the middle. You have the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Then maybe the late 50s, early 60s, you have the Gospels. What fills in the middle? The apostolic letter period, where Paul is traveling around the Mediterranean world writing letters to the churches. Paul fills in that gap. What was the earliest book that Paul wrote? Maybe Galatians could have been written as early as 47 AD. Now that's only 17 years after the resurrection. So Paul's writing, there is that period. There's the oral period of preaching. Then there is the apostolic letters. And then there are the Gospels. So you have evidence of the resurrection running through there. 16, even critical New Testament scholars accept certain minimal facts about the resurrection. Gary Habermas says that virtually all of the Jesus seminar, for example, they believe Jesus was indeed crucified and killed. They believe that the followers of Jesus, or some of the followers of Jesus, were actually seeing something. They were having kind of religious visions or something. They also believe that they died. They believe the tomb was empty. And Habermas says the reason they accept these minimal facts is because most of them are undeniable. Now when people who hold a fundamentally different view than you do start confirming some of your evidence, then I think that counts quite effectively. 17, all naturalistic explanations for the resurrection have proven false. So let's adopt naturalism. We're going to sit at the feet of the patron saint of skepticism, David Hume, and we open up Hume's writings and we think about his criticism of miracles, and he says, look, there's never been a group of educated, thoughtful, critically minded people who have investigated miracles and shown them to be true. Well, I'd like to introduce Hume to Thomas and to James and to Paul. What kind of integrity did they have? I tend to trust people who are willing to pull it all on the line. I have been afraid in my life. I know what it's like to be afraid. I also know what it's like for my life to be transformed. Now, if God doesn't exist and the resurrection is false, then give me a naturalistic explanation. In my latest book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I look at eight of the top explanations and I point out why all of them are very faulty. Not just kind of faulty. They just don't make a lot of sense. They don't explain things. Number 18, the resurrection explains the emergence and the rapid spread of Christianity. Hey, if the resurrection didn't happen, where did Christianity come from? Why is it there? Why do I just drive down the street and there's a Lutheran church and a Presbyterian church and a Catholic church and an Orthodox church and a Pentecostal church? Why has there been this world movement called Christianity? Where did it come from except because of the resurrection? So the resurrection explains what I would call the emergence and rapid spread of Christianity. By the way, the two major people groups who joined Christianity right away, women and slaves. Why? Because neither one of them had any rights at all. And when they heard this man from Galilee, they said, I'm in. I'm in. He talks the way the Old Testament prophets talk. Was it Houston Smith, one of the great educators of the world's religions? He said, on Mount Olympus, the gods pursue beautiful maidens. They are made in the image of man. He said, on Sinai, Yahweh's interested in widows, orphans, immigrants, people who have no power. That's what led to, who is this man? Why? How has he come up with these things? All people are made in the image of God. Everyone has dignity and value. Love your brother. Love your neighbor. Christianity goes. So many women became Christians that the Romans thought, is this a feminist cult? No, it's because Greeks and Romans, none of them treated women with any respect. And here's Jesus, he's talking to women at the well, he's having dialogue. The two or three women who encounter the resurrection are women. But by the way, if I made it all up, I wouldn't have made them women because a woman's testimony in court didn't carry the same authority as that as a man. But there's this embarrassing point. The first encounter of Jesus is to his women followers. 18. 19, that Jesus rose bodily from the dead is the best explanation of the data. In logic, we have three forms of reasoning, three forms of arguments, deductive, inductive, and abductive. By the way, the beings on the UFOs, they prefer abduction over deduction and induction. Now, that might not be terribly funny, but I came up with that joke, so I'm original. There is what we call abductive reasoning, and it's inference to the best explanation. It's what scientists do. When scientists develop a hypothesis, they engage in diagnostic abductive reasoning. When doctors develop... You know, when I go to my doctor, he looks at my chart. He talks to me. Well, what kind of problems are you having? They look at the blood test, and then he makes a diagnosis. Abductive reasoning, explanatory reasoning. Now I know the resurrection is supernatural. Now I know the resurrection isn't like anything you've ever heard before. Nothing that's ever happened in history before, but I do think it's the best explanation. And then finally, all of these evidence together build a powerful cumulative case for the resurrection. So it's not just one argument, two arguments, three arguments, four. When you put them all together, the evidential basis is even more. I think we have good reason to believe that death is not the end. I think we have good reason to believe that Jesus was the Son of God. And I'm not the only one. Here's N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright is probably, I won't even use the word probably, he is one of the leading New Testament scholars in the world. Notice what he says here in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, Volume 3. He says, the empty tomb and the meetings with Jesus, that's the appearances, the empty tomb and the meetings with Jesus, when combined, present us with not only a sufficient condition for the rise of the early Christian belief, but also, it seems, a necessary one. Nothing else historians have been able to come up with this has the power to explain the phenomena before us. That's a powerful statement by one of the leading New Testament historians in the world. Here's another extraordinary statement by Antony Flew. Now, when I was studying philosophy early on, I studied the old atheists. I've read the new atheists. I think the old atheists are more formidable. I had to read Antony Flew. I had to read A.J. Ayer. I had to read Jean-Paul Sartre. I had to read Bertrand Russell, Friedrich Nietzsche. I think they were more formidable than Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and Dennett. Why? Because the old atheists, they studied Christianity. And they knew enough about it. They were looking for the soft underbelly. Nietzsche used to say, by the way, Nietzsche was born into a Lutheran family. His father was a Lutheran pastor. His father contracted some infectious disease and died. Nietzsche said in his writings, I could always remember the first time I heard Handel's Messiah. So Nietzsche knew a lot about Christianity. He used to say to Christians, he used to needle them and say, you know, I might believe in your Redeemer if you would act a little more redeemed. See, the old atheists, they got it. They knew the rough areas. And hypocrisy is a problem in Christianity. It always has been. Look what Flew says. He's a philosopher, former prominent atheist. Antony Flew says this. He says, the evidence for the resurrection is better than for claimed miracles in any other religion. It's outstandingly different in quality and quantity. Can I read that again? That must be mistaken. No, Antony Flew was a leading atheist until he started studying the resurrection. And he didn't come the whole way. He became a deist. I think before he died, I don't think he was a Christian, but who knows what the Lord can do. But I have no reason to think Flew was a Christian. Flew, this atheist of atheists, says, the evidence for the resurrection is better than for claimed miracles of any other religion. It's outstandingly different in quality and quantity, close quote. Those are my 20 evidences for the resurrection of Jesus. There are times I have doubts. I'm a flawed person. I'm also a finite person. There are some times where I do have doubts. Sometimes I think, Lord, why'd you let that happen? Or what's your plan in this? But I think we have very good... We have a strong rational basis for believing that our faith is rooted in history. And in this book, I try to do two things, because it used to be people asked truth questions. When I worked at the Christian Research Institute back in the late 80s and the early 90s, I worked with Walter Martin. In those days, when I would go to the college campuses, students would ask me truth questions. Did Jesus rise from the dead? Is Jesus the Son of God? Does God exist? I move forward 35 years. The last 10 or 15 years I've worked here at Reasons to Believe with Hugh Ross. By the way, I'll be in an airport and people will say, did you work for Walter Martin? Did you work for Hugh Ross? And I proudly say, yes. two extraordinary Christian men, two extraordinary Christian thinkers. The idea, though, is that 15 years ago, I started to notice when I'd go to the college campus, students aren't all that interested in truth. They start asking me whether Christianity is good. Has it been good for women? Has it been good for racial minorities? What about the Inquisition? What about the Crusades? Why doesn't the Bible forthrightly condemn slavery? And I thought, ah. I think today we have to be not only ready to give evidence that Christianity is rational, reasonable, and true, I think we also need to make a case for why you should hope Christianity is true. I read this book by Tom Holland called Dominion. He is a Roman historian, a British atheist. He studied church history, knows it really well. He said, you know, after I studied Western civilization and history, he said, even though I'm an atheist, he says, with my ethics, I'm a Christian. I'm not a Roman. I am not a Greek. My ethics are not atheistic. I am a Christian in my ethics. Started going to church. Does he believe in God? Does he believe in Christ? I don't have any idea. But he looked at Western civilization and said, with all of the flaws and the faults, Christianity has been a powerful source for good for the world. Let me stop there because I know we have some questions. I got a little bit long, but I didn't want to leave you with 19 arguments for the resurrection. You'd be telling Hugh, bring him back. I got to get that 20th. So I'm hoping we have some time for Q&A. And do we get to ask questions in the room and then streaming as well? Is that the way it works?
We do both. We alternate from one to the other.
Very good.
So does anybody in the room have a question right now? Yes.
Hi, Ken. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
How would you respond to someone who says, before we can provide evidence for the resurrection, we need for a skeptic, we need to convince him that God exists. Otherwise, he's just going to say, I get your evidences, but I'm a naturalist. I have no idea what happened, but I'm just sure that it happened in some natural way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, part of that context comes out of what we call apologetic methodology. Christians through the centuries have come at how to defend the truth of Christianity. Do we start with the existence of God and appeal to natural theology, cosmological, teleological, moral, ontological? Or do we look at the historical data itself, maybe that there really was an Abraham and Moses, there was an Exodus, Jesus is a historical figure, evidentialism, the first one would be more of a classical approach. Other people have come along and talked about other approaches. One approach that is popular among particularly Reformed people is called presuppositional apologetics, that nobody is neutral and you should therefore begin with their relationship with God. I'm not terribly fond of apologetic methodology. I would rather talk with non-Christians about my faith and their lack of faith than debate with other Christians how to do apologetics. Now, some of my critics might say, well, can you say that because you're not being faithful to a biblical context? Well, I may have some need to grow in some of those areas. I think I'd answer the question by saying this. Look, if you'd like evidence for God's existence, I think we can provide some pretty strong arguments. If that's where you'd like to begin, if you can't get to the Gospels and historical resurrection and the truth of the Bible, if you want to say, I don't even know if God exists, why should I believe any of that? I think there are some very powerful evidences, multiple arguments from cosmology, the Kalam, which argues from the beginning of the universe, from contingency, moral arguments, teleological arguments. I think there are some good ones there. If you want to look at the evidentiary historical, I think we score high there. If you want to talk about psychological evidences for a religious experience, so I wouldn't debate somebody who says maybe you have a different starting point than where I start from. I'd say, okay, but wherever you want to start from, I think I've got some good data to help you get from there to here.
Okay. We have a question online from Keith Wilson, and he asked, how do you manage your different levels of certitude about truth claims in fields outside your own when they are seemingly presented flat and you don't have the expertise or time to investigate?
Yeah, good question, fair question. Obviously there's evidence, right? There's evidence. You looked at what I think are 20 evidences for the resurrection. But you have evidence on one hand, you have persuasion on the other. You have evidence on one hand, and then you have what Keith here is referencing, a sliding scale of certitude, right? Now, if you ask me, for example, do I think what the Nazis did to the Jews was evil? Do I have 100% certainty that that was evil? Yes, I do. I think what Hitler did to the Jews, I have a certainty that that was evil, like I see you sitting there right now. I don't have any doubts that murdering a whole group of people who are innocent simply because you differ with their political or religious views, that's evil. Torturing children, I was watching today a report on, it was a Catholic channel I was watching, human trafficking. So there are people, particularly in third world countries, men who go out and trap young women. Tell them, hey, you know, let's go out and have a drink. Let's go out and have a party. And then they drug them, they kidnap them, and they sell them into a life of slavery. Well, the hottest place in hell may be where those people are going to end up. That's evil. I don't have any doubts about that. Now, there are other things I do have a sliding scale, right? People have differing ideas. Did the universe have an exact origination? I think so. But I've talked with some physicists, and they're not completely certain. They say, well, you know, maybe it did have an exact origination. But, you know, we can't have that. So, Keith, I'm going to try to directly answer your question. I don't think you have to be an expert on the New Testament or on historical evidence or logic to say that we have some robust evidence to support the resurrection. Now, when it comes to our certitude, I have doubts. I think some of my doubts are because there's a conflict about an issue, and maybe I'm like, wow, I don't know how to tackle that. I don't know how to work all the way through. So I feel like I've got to step back a little bit. But you know what? Some of my other doubts are psychological insecurities. Sometimes I have trouble trusting authorities. So I have a kind of a cycle of like, Lord, I looked at my 401k the other day. Lord, it's now a 201k. I'm getting to be an old man. I got to retire pretty soon. Do you really have control over the money markets? I'm using that as a joke, but it is a point that I make. Sometimes the insecurities we have are psychological. They're not intellectual. So, Keith, if I can address your question, I don't think you have to know everything about everything. I think if you read some good sources and you think carefully about the truth of Christianity, I think we've got good evidence, and so does N.T. Wright. And so are some atheists who come along. They say, wow, I didn't know there was that much evidence in favor of Christianity. Next question, yes.
Professor Samples, this is Bud. If I can sort of ask a more general question
sure.
than the resurrection.
Sure.
You mentioned getting moral good questions on university campuses
yeah.
in the recent years versus truth questions from the past. I've thought about this a lot, and I figure that your wisdom may help. How do you reach children? Rather than try to gradate intellectual capabilities of adults across the span, just say middle schoolers. How do you reach middle schoolers for the gospel of Christ? Because my personal opinion on it, based on my own experience in going to college, yeah. if you wait until college, if you wait until high school to reach these young people, you've waited too long, especially in today's society. I mean, you have already passed the sweet spot of being able to reach people for the gospel. How do you reach them when you're younger? That's it. Thank you.
Great question. Very, very appropriate, applicable. Of course, Christianity came from a context of pre-modernism. Then there was modernism with the Enlightenment period, and science, instead of trusting in the ways of God, we trust in the ways of man and science. Then postmodern comes along and says, maybe there really aren't objective truth and morality. Maybe there's just power play, and maybe it has to do with what's practical. I think that you should never underestimate the power of philosophy. I think many of the challenges we are experiencing in our culture today go back to philosophical systems. These were systems that philosophers were talking about a long period of time. Nietzsche said, look, God's dead. And what he meant was, Western civilization is dependent upon God. Science was established by God. All of our ethics have been established by God, but now the intelligentsia in the Western world doesn't believe on God. This is going to lead to a shipwreck. All of our foundation is based upon the biblical God, but we no longer believe in him. Then how do we condemn slavery? Then how do we trust in science? I think Nietzsche was right on target. So now we're at the other end where people say, look, true for you, true for me, good for you, not so good for me. I completely agree. My wife and I, we have three kids. They're now 35, 31, and 27. So we've passed through the period of educating them at home and sending them to college and things like that. I would say this, what I did with my children is I really engaged them when they were young. I taught them challenges to their worldview. I said, here's atheism, and here are the key atheists, and here's what they think. Here's what they believe. And I talked about science and evolution, and here are the science challenges. I wanted my kids to feel comfortable thinking about issues in the context of our home. And so I had them read Secular People as part of the classics of Western civilization. I think that it helped a great deal when they went away to college because they'd heard this stuff before. I remember my daughter saying in a logic class she took, she said, I'm like the only one in here who's ever studied logic. So I think the church and I think Christian civilization and I think Christian homes have lots of challenges on their hands these days. A Catholic thinker said, he's the founder of Ignatius Press up in San Francisco, produces a lot of apologetic literature, by the way. He said, every home has to be a monastery. Just like in the Dark Ages, where the priests would establish education and learning, and Christianity would be reinforced. I think every home has to be a monastery, is what this one Catholic thinker was saying. I think there's a lot of truth in that. There's a lot of philosophical ideas, but please do not tell me that philosophy is not important. There are a lot of philosophical systems that are challenging the truth of Christianity. It's not just gray-haired old philosophers in Ivy League schools who believe this. It's filtered out into the culture. So I agree with you. I think we need strong churches. I think we need strong homes. We need strong marriages. We need vibrant classes where people are taught to think and to reason. I think every church ought to have a doubters class where the invitation is only come if you've got doubts. And you can ask anything you want. I think that those are kind of the challenges we face.
Ken, I think we're out of time. Unfortunately, I have to apologize to people in our online audience. We're not going to be able to get to all their questions. Can you close us in prayer, Ken?
Yes. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we are so grateful, Lord, that you sent your Son into the world. He is your Son, and he's our Savior. And Father, your Son tells us that if we're weary and burdened, we can come to him, and he will give us rest and peace for our soul. And Father, you not only gave us your Son, you gave us your Spirit. And your Spirit is our helper. He is our advocate. He's the one who comes alongside us like a paramedic to help us. Father, you're so good. You've given us your right hand, your Son, your left hand, your Spirit. Lord, I pray that you will bless all the people here today, whether they're in building or whether they're online. I pray that you, Father, will allow us to come closer to you, and we come through your Son and by your Spirit. And so we praise you, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you very much. Thank you. Tell that Hugh Ross, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.